Good morning. Welcome back to the Edge and Flow podcast. I'm sitting here with Lucas Burnley. My name is TJ Schwartz, and we're going to discuss what we always do, which is knife making, knife design, the life of making knives and being in this world, and probably many other things. How you doing, man?
Dude, I'm doing good. Ready to go. Ready to
Yeah.
chat.
Yeah, we missed another couple. You went to Blade Show, Texas, and had a lot of fun.
Yeah, man.
Got some heat.
Year's ramping up pretty good
Yeah,
for
it's going
both of
fast too. It's
us.
already mid-March, the Ides of March.
The Ides of March. Yeah, it actually feels not as stressful missing episodes now that we've kind of like come up with our free form schedule. Just something I look forward to is something that's feeling
Yeah,
was feeling like a little bit of an obligation.
this is great.
So
And we have more to talk about, I think. When you lower the frequency, maybe a touch, it's a little higher density.
well, it comes in
Yeah.
waves. Like, I mean, at this point, like, you and I don't really have a whole lot of dead space, but we are in something for long enough to not have anything new to talk about, I guess. Right, but not the case today. Dude, can we just start with the show since it's like on my mind?
Let's do it.
So went to Blade Show, Texas. This was just a walking show for me. Didn't have a table or a booth. And yeah, it's you've never been to that show, right? You have thought about doing it. I have multiple thoughts on it this year. And I'm trying to figure out how to like eloquently put it. I think as a show, it has some of the most potential to be just like a real workhorse. Like what I would have considered shows 15 years ago, where it's kind of like one room, kind of custom dominated with some production companies. The landscape there has changed so much because there's so many micro like production. So that's kind of interspersed into the custom stuff. And also just having like it's in a location that works well for knife shows. Like you get enough local people coming in that are actually knife interested that I think creates a lot of value. The thing that I heard the most was that it felt like old Blade. And that's like pretty high praise for a show. For a bigger show, right? But if this would be a show that if you were a knife maker who's been working for a few years, maybe haven't done a show, want to go out, want to start meeting people, like this would be a very good show. I still maintain that Blade Atlanta is probably the biggest overall value for like that side. It's just you get access to everybody. Okay. And with Blade Atlanta, one of the biggest benefits is the pit, which is like the de facto social club post show where you can really connect with people. That's the one thing that Blade Texas doesn't have.
Same with Blade West.
Yeah, same with Blade West. And most shows don't actually have that. But I think when I look at value of a show, value being primarily community and kind of just connection, I think that part is that could be add any show where that does work at, it adds a huge value. The USN show had what did they like Trader's Cove or something like that, but basically everyone would show up to a little bar afterwards. So that is like as a show, I would try pretty hard to create that. So it doesn't exist, Blade Texas. The flip side of the coin is that like the energy felt down. So two things are true. Like the show was good. I think some people had a, like obviously like luck of the draw like sometimes, but there were people that had a great show, people that were not stoked, but the overall just like energy felt down, like less stoke.
It's an interesting observation. How do you feel about that? Do you have any thoughts on what the what the origin of that is?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure in this case. I think it's probably tied to like a little bit of general weariness in the industry around how many shows there are, and then probably just like the economy and some of the stuff that we're dealing with on social media, as far as like what's being seen, not seen in the knife industry. It just like for years and years and years, I remember going to shows and just seeing people so excited. And that energy didn't seem to be there. And that was kind of on the maker side and kind of on the customer side. Like not like resigned, just not quite like
Yeah, not that Comic-Con sort of
No, that's
wonder.
exactly it. Like where we say like in our industry, one of the things that separates us is the passion. It's like that was that just I don't know, man. It might just be lacking. I think there's another component to this, which is early 2000s to like mid 2000s, a lot of the groups were pretty unified. So like you would go to the forums and the forums would be where all the makers were, and then you'd go to a show and you'd kind of link up with the people from the forum. So this is Blade Forums, Knife and Gun Network, USN, what, Knife Dogs, there's a bunch of them. Now everybody is spread out. So kind of all the makers have their own groups. Kind of the collectors do. There's so many shows that I think that just the general, like while the community itself is probably larger, I don't think that the group is larger. I think
Tell
it's
me
scattered.
if this sounds right to you. It seems like the forum era is a golden era and was such an ideal way to cultivate like the modern knife industry as we know it, with that like kind of one hive mind aspect that you're describing. And then Instagram came up, which had a way better user interface, way better ability to share, way better reach. So everyone moved to that, and it was like the great migration. And then I hate to say it, but it was like basically the great betrayal of Instagram basically crushing that whole community. And now everyone just scattered. Does that sound like
Yeah, I
the
think
macro
so.
trend?
Yeah, and I think it ties in also Facebook was the save, but it's also like you look at it and you're like it's not owned land. A forum was like owned by someone essentially, and kind of they could just like they could specify what actions happened in that forum. Facebook brought the forum aspect back, but it's not a forum. So like we've got our Burnley Knives group. Dude, there's 10,000 members in there, but there's not 300,000 members that are all linked because they like knives and are kind of cross posting and everything else.
They're all there for Burnley, or they're all there
Yeah.
for
And
whichever
they're,
brand.
dude, I mean, that's the thing. Like, as a collector at this point, like, dude, I bet a lot of them are in 20, 30 groups. There's so much crossover, but it's still kind of. It's not like a unified thing. There's like little satellite groups, and it's again, that's just like a gut response to seeing like the shows. So as a cautionary tale, or like I guess like a parallel to this, I think the shows themselves are similar, which is at this point, it's easy for shows to damage another show that is like a legacy show because they bring out something that is like new, fun, exciting, novel. And I say this as someone who is deeply attracted to all of those things, without realizing or caring that it may be shifts the industry. Like there, I think there are decisions being made that actually do move the needle in ways that make it hard to pivot back. Yeah, I think it'll self-correct a little bit. But like USN show kind of going away, it would be one of those where, you have a show that's been going for, I don't know what, 14 years, and it was a show that was very beneficial to a lot of makers, and it kind of fell out of vogue, because now it's like, well, now you can do like a one night show, or now you can do this. And obviously there needs to be variation, and there's not a re I'm not saying like, oh, like this shouldn't be happening. I'm just saying I think it is happening. Right. So we might be evolving out of a certain type of show and certain type of community. I realize this sounds like a really big statement, but it was just an observation. I was there for, 2 days walking around, hanging out and talking to people.
Well, the sands always shift.
Yeah.
I can, I've, you know, I've been, I'm still kind of a young pup at most knife makers, but I've been in the industry just long enough to see that a little bit
Yeah.
because I can remember the 2015, 2016 era and what that felt like. And then after that felt different than the COVID era. It's
Yeah.
like there's three or four distinct eras of the knife industry and the blade show sort of world. Just since I've been doing things since about 2012. So I think it's the one thing you can count on is that that's the way it's going to be. So it's
Yeah.
interesting, you know. It's fun to watch in terms of macro trends.
Yeah.
What are people liking? But what one thing, I guess the reason I'm saying that, one thing that gives me optimism is I remember there was a feeling like this, felt similar to me about 2015 or 14. I think there was a similar slump sort of feeling going on, particularly in like custom knives and stuff. And here we are. It feels similar again. But guess what? After 2015 era was one of the biggest boom eras as well. So it was booming before and after that period.
Yeah.
So, you know, is it cyclical? Is it
Yeah.
random? You know, but it's not a new feeling to me,
No.
even so. It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't think, I'm sure that some of it is cyclical, and then some of it is, I think the situations change enough that like maybe the fact that it will change is cyclical, but now it's like a new thing. Like talking about, 2020 knife boom. I mean, that was real. That was, everybody was up. People changed the way they did business, grew businesses, and then it dropped off. And we're probably still somewhere in that drop off. I look at a lot of these as catalyst for change. So I don't see it as a negative. I just get really curious. So when I go to a show and I'm like, huh, like this feels different, I just start looking at it from like, okay, what does that mean? And like, what is the next step? Like, how can we improve it if it's something that we don't want? Or how can I change to adapt to it? And it's like kind of an unknown. I would love to hear, like, this would be a fun one to have just a panel of people like give their experience on shows. And this would be like, so I'm reading that book on Bergmaster. I'm almost done with it.
Nice.
And it's again basically history of a company from like a engineer type building his company up, family owned business, scaled, gets bought by like a conglomerate, grows, and then this tying in with import and like Japan and all of these things. It's really, really in-depth story. One of the things that I love about it is it gives time frame, like understanding of things that were happening in industry. Knife industry is really small, but people write books on knife industry all the time. Like I would love to see, Blade or somebody start writing books on like the industry. Like here's, okay, so you say like the 2000s, golden, it's like a golden era, right? maybe the 70s were a golden era, or the 80s. It's like it would be so rad to have like an overarching kind of history of the industry. So that's a book that needs to happen.
Oh, for sure. And
Right?
the knife industry is small enough that none of the companies are publicly traded.
Yeah.
And so that's one interesting comparison to some of these other trends that are macro that you see is
Yeah.
that they look at, public trading trends,
Yeah.
and you can make like really strong arguments with real data when you have all that stuff.
Yeah.
But nobody knows, what's happening in reality in the knife industry. It's all, walled off. So it's kind of like each person has to have their circle, and people, share things in confidence and things like that. So it'd be cool. You're right. If that narrative was able to be developed with like a little bit of data to back it up, you know what I mean? That you would have to get, on foot. You'd have to be talking to people to
You'd
get
have
that
to talk, but
information.
the so we're not super far away from people that were, at least in like the US knife industry. We obviously like we've lost portions of generations, but there's still makers that were there very, very early on and can talk about like the flow of the industry. I just like you said, we're not public, like companies aren't publicly traded. So Bergmaster was. So this book is a Harvard Business Review, right? We're probably not going to get that. But as an industry as a whole, like it would be super rad. Like if you can have a coffee table book on Lyle that looks like, a phone book. You can have a book on the industry that goes through some of the really interesting periods, trends, like shifts. Like, dude, I mean, social media, CNC, like there's, I mean, just those as two top level have been shifts, but like what happened in the 80s and 90s? What were the shifts? When Emerson did a production folder, like what was that like? Shows up with like what was it like the Raven with injection molded scales. You're like, what happened when Benchmade started to like really
The
become
access
like,
lock, yeah.
yeah, dude, like those things, like, because in retrospect, you can look and you can see how the industry pivoted around that. Ken doing Speed Safe,
I was going to
right?
mention
Like,
that.
that's like endless, man.
Yeah. No, I would love to read a book like that. If it was, I don't know how, I mean, man, what a job to write a book like that, how to, gather that data, but it would be super informative, kind of like I was saying, if you're in the insurance business, or you're in the auto business, or you're in the this or the that, that you can like get on a newsletter or read a, reports about these trends that we're talking about. But
That's an
yeah.
interesting one. Like if you, I wonder what the prompts would be with like an LLM to get like, give me a 15 page synopsis of like major changes in the knife industry from the 1980s on. I'm gonna do that because now I'm really curious. Yeah, I don't know. I think that would be a cool book. If anybody's listening that is like writing knife books, please write that one.
Yeah, I love it.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, other than that, man, Texas, closing out that thought, had some good barbecue, got to like catch up with people, which was really nice. And yeah, man, that's like, it's good. It's a really good show. Like if you are a maker and you're looking for a show that feels like a traditional knife show, I think it is one of the best value propositions out there. Like Texas, you go to Fort Worth, it's easy to get to. There's some good food. The weather's usually nice, not this year. And I will say that the community at this show, I still saw enough of like my collectors and my friends to see that like people are going to this show, and it may just be kind of early days in a period of time where there is some like show overload, and it'll come out of it, but yeah, like it would be a good show for you. Like it's an outdoorsman show
Yeah,
too,
that's
where
interesting.
if someone comes in off the street to look at knives, there's a good chance that they maybe are a hunter or maybe do something outside, or and have the resources to like look at a knife and be like, oh, $400, like that's rad, I want that.
Yeah.
So
No, I'd love to get down there. I was there 2 years ago, but I was there the weekend before the show,
I
which is
remember that. You
ironic.
missed it.
I was hanging out with Tactile. We were working on the Archer project and whatnot.
Yeah.
And we were going to meet up at the show, but we decided it was better for us to be able to focus if we did
Yeah.
it like
Just
before.
go. Do you feel like overall, do you feel similar about Blade West where, because I went with you the first year just to walk it. And that was I was like, huh, okay. Overall, it's not like a hype show. But it just seemed like people were there. People were a lot of people walking in, but in a community where that seems like a good fit.
Yeah, no, it's that's what it comes down to for me is Blade West is not the mega show. It's not the most exciting show probably for most,
Yeah.
but it is the best fitting show that I have ever been to for our brand.
Yeah.
Because when you're talking about like the Overland knife and the outdoorsy and the hunting and that whole scene, like Salt Lake City is of the best cities in the world for
Yeah,
that
and the
demographic.
region
So
in general,
yeah, exactly. You got
like,
Moab down there. It's
yeah.
ideal.
Yeah.
So I just feel like we fit there. So that's why it's probably my favorite Blade show currently. With Atlanta being a nod to it being the king, you know what I
Yeah.
mean?
Yeah.
But I don't know how that translates for other brands at Blade Show West, because like I said, it's such a fit for us. Does it? I don't know how other people do. I really don't.
There's a good thought there though, which is like if you haven't done a show yet or you're doing a show and you want to know what to add, talking to other makers and really getting like the lay of the land from a standpoint of like, is this a good fit for me, for what I want out of my business? One of the
Fit
nice
matters.
things, yeah, it really does. Like one of the nice things, or even as a collector, because one of the things that you have to look at is like you go to a show like Blade, if you're following someone with higher demand, like you're in an area where a lot of people are going there to get to that maker. Some of the smaller shows, like you have better odds. So if you're hunting like specific pieces, sometimes like going to a smaller show allows you to do that if that maker's there, but it also allows you to see new makers. And that's really important. Like at this point, I have like institutional collectors that have just been with me for 15 years, right? And that is I think both as a maker and as a collector, that's a really important relationship to foster, but you have to have an entry point. Last thing about Texas, I wanted to give a shout out to Jonah Boatman from Dull Boy Blades. Dude, that was a mouthful. Edit that. I had a long talk with him just hanging out in the aisle. He's working on some really cool stuff and was just like a very genuine human.
That's
So,
great. Yeah.
yeah, check him out. Where are we going?
Yeah, I have had some good developments in the shop on the production side, if we want to dive into that. And it
Lay it
kind of
out.
ties into another announcement you have.
Okay, you start.
So we've been bevel grinding with the X9. I think that's pretty clear by now. And we went from milling to grinding bevels. And when we were milling bevels, we had a lot of handwork to get the finish on the bevel to be appropriate for stonewash. And it's always been the biggest thorn in our side of the milling the bevels and the stoning them. Kind of like I've said a long time ago, is that it's stable and reliable. In fact, oh, insanely reliable, basically zero scrap. Everything, it always works, but it's not that efficient. It's not really efficient at all, actually. And it's not only an efficiency thing, but it's a scalability thing. Because if you are just going to have more and more and more bevels to stone, you're going to have a hard time keeping employees to do that job. It's not a fun job. No one wants to do it. It's slow. And so that's why we got the X9. So it got delivered. We started grinding. We still had to stone. for a little while, and it was better but different. So it was like the lines are now going the other direction, so and the finish is better, but we found it was actually kind of tricky to stone them when they're going the other way, because all of his muscle memory, particularly Dalton, was for the lines that were parallel to the edge. And so when they all flipped, so you had some lines going perpendicular to the edge, he basically had to change the way that he was stoning, and that stone has like a lot of reciprocation. And so like coming into the plunge, if you come in parallel to the lines that are you're trying to remove, it won't remove them. You have to go perpendicular. And so trying not to roll out edges and trying not to get the plunge. So while it was a huge success when we started bevel grinding, we kind of felt like, dang, like this didn't quite get us there. You know what I mean? And so I kind of sat down and I was like, I think there's some settings on pretty much all CNC machines about tolerances and finishing and smoothing and precision. And I downloaded the user manual for the control for the style. And I just started searching terms like smoothing and anything that has to do with like contour control, precision, like just words that would come up, because it's a list of all the parameters in the manual, but there's like 4,000 of them. And most of them are not relevant to the person who owns the machine. It's relevant because it's like calibration metrics and like,
right,
okay, when the spindle goes up and waits for a tool change, how many milliseconds does it wait?
Does you know, it dwell?
Stuff yeah. that it's like, I don't care. But to sift through and find these keywords, I'll show you right here. I found like three or four parameters and I printed out the pages with the parameters, and they have an amazing manual with really good like documentation. Every single parameter had like bullet points of what it does, even like depictions of what it is that it's Whoa. Talking about. And so I just fell in love with this manual and started just reading a bunch of these parameters, and I printed them, highlighted the ones that I thought I was going to need. And I went over there, and this one parameter 407, which is called HPCC, which is high precision contour control, which is a form of look ahead. So the machine,
the look ahead, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the machine had look ahead from the factory. I knew that because it's in their marketing stuff. But I didn't really know if that was just on all the time,
right,
or like if you have to turn it on or whatever. And so that's why I started digging into this. And what look ahead is like when a machine is running code, it's going through coordinates. So when it's grinding through that bevel, it's going to hit a bunch of points, and it's not necessarily going to make a curve. It's going to make a polygon, because it's going to go from right. one point to the next, to the next, to the next. And so that polygonal moving from point to point was causing like a facet. So it's like every time there would be a point, because in Fusion, I can look at the points. I can have it show me where the points are
right.
on the code. And I could look at the grind and I could see that there was
exactly
an aberration at each point. And it was like identical on every knife, no matter what you did with any of the feeds and speeds, because it's moving not in a smooth way. It's moving in a linear way, right?
It's like lurchy.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. Like what is the tolerance? Like when you're talking about this, like what is a big step?
A big step? Like
like what's a big point to point? Where you are seeing that line.
So what the best we could get it was that you can up a number of points in Fusion by changing the tolerance. And so if we made it so that there was like, let's say right. from on an Overland Sport on a 3-inch-ish blade, if we had like, I don't know, 400 points, mm-hmm. it would be about as good as we could get it, because you have less of that kind of polygonal straight line right. action.
Yeah, if you think about points on like an arc, if you have three going across the arc, it's making some judgments of how that's shaped.
Yeah.
And what would if 400 is the best, what do you think it like what would it have been at?
Just like straight out of the box, if you posted that a Fusion, you may only are going to get like 10 or 12 points going down that bevel.
Yeah.
You're going to have a point every like 3/16 of an inch or so.
Okay. That makes 3/16 so.
But we could only get it so good, because I kept cranking that tolerance and cranking that tolerance. But you can only go so far before you're actually starting to hurt yourself, because the rate at which it starts to read code, you look at the screen going through the G code, and it's like mm-hmm. a blur. And eventually you start to get aberrations because it's too many points. And it's basically the machine is like, it's just, it can't interpret them quite fast enough to do it in a smooth way.
Mm-hmm.
So we were kind of playing with like the boundaries of that, and we got a lot of improvement. I was happy enough. But I turned this feature on, this HPCC, and there's a second parameter that is the tolerance for. So if you can imagine what the HPCC is, and they have a picture that shows it on this thing, maybe I'll post it on Instagram. The idea is you're telling the machine to look ahead at the points ahead of you instead of just going from this point to that point. And then when you get to that point, look at the next point, and it's just segmented like that. It's mm-hmm. saying you're telling it, look at all of the points going down that bevel and create a smooth average of them, which is exactly what we want to happen. Mm-hmm. And then there's a tolerance that you can allow the machine to miss a point by up to the amount that you put in. Because if you want it to be smooth, it has to miss points, because instead of a polygon, it's got to actually average them out and kind of like not necessarily directly intersect every point.
Right.
And so the illustration they have on here, it's kind of like a race car driver going around a track. It's like you have a really curvy track, but they're trying to make like the smoothest, least curvy line through the track. And that's kind of like the picture is it displaying. So I cranked the tolerance as high as it would go to allow it as much liberty to deviate and just see what the machine was capable of. So now the machine's like on autopilot. It's like, okay, I'm looking at these points. I'm going to move through them the best way that I can in a smooth as possible way. So I turned that on, ran five bevels. It was ridiculous. There is not a grind line. There is not an aberration. There is not a tolerance issue. We threw the five of them in the tumbler without touching them with a stone. They look like the best bevels I've ever come out of our shop, and they have not been stoned. And so
it was shocking. You sent me pictures. It is shocking. With stone washing, it will bring out any defect.
Any. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There were no defects.
Yeah. In five blades, which means 10 bevels left, right, they were exactly the same. And the style just averaged those points. And interestingly, we actually ran one and I could still see some aberrations. But what I found is when you're doing the averaging method with this HPCC, you need to have less points, because if you have too many points, like if you have those 400 points, mm-hmm. there's not very much leeway for it to create that curve.
That's
because
smooth curve.
There's just too many points to average them realistically. So I dropped it back down to the factory output from Fusion, which is, like I said, a point every like 3/16. And that is what got us that finish, because the style is looking at those points, and instead of drawing straight lines between them, it's drawing a spline that hits all the points roughly.
Got it.
And so it's like, it's perfect, dude. It's perfect.
That is, man. Yeah, that it makes sense. It also, the fact that you like go in and are looking at parameters and stuff on your machine is crazy to me. That stuff's terrifying.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, it does a few things too, which is like hand stoning a blade. Like, obviously you're removing handwork, but like you said, it's the best looking bevel. It's because it's like you're removing an entire operation that can create some deviation of surface. So like the plunges are going to look the same. One question to two questions. One, did the speed change?
No.
Insane.
It's exactly the same. Yeah.
Okay. And with the CBN wheels, I've never used anything with CBN. There's no like dressing that happens.
No.
So the only thing you have to worry about is damage, and there is wear.
Mm-hmm.
What is the wear range for this process?
So we've been able to say that with an Overland Sport, again, like a 2¾-inch blade, 130,000 stock thickness. So on the small side for a fixed blade, but maybe super mid-range for a folder.
Sure.
It's that wheel's probably going to grind in the thousands of knives.
Yeah, okay.
So I mean, we from the looks of it, that wheel is going to last us years.
Yeah.
So I mean, because we control the obviously it is wearing, and so you offset the Z height of your whole program down to compensate for that. But so I guess I could figure that out and let you know, because I took a picture of what the Z was when we first started, because I was like, I want to know what that is, because what we're running at the Z height now, because we never touch it off, we just manually drop our work offset to drop that grind down, down, down.
So, and you're doing that based on what dimension?
Edge thickness.
So you mic a blade when it's done and you're like, oh, we went from 12 to 13. Is that like at what point do you notice it or change it?
So here's that it gets a little muddy because there's thermal,
Yeah.
because the X9 is a huge machine, and so it can move as it's warmed up in the morning. It could move like maybe a thou, which is still not very much, but and so usually in the morning, you don't want to start your first grinding like at the bottom of your tolerance range for edge thickness. You want to start at the top, because for the first like five blades, the spindle is growing a little bit. And so if you keep in mind, if the spindle gets a thou deeper by
Right, you lose
thermal,
two
it
thou off
used
the
two
edge.
thou on the edge, which is substantial. And so we start at the top of our range, and then the thermal starts to make the bevel go deeper. And then after a while, it's plateaued at that max depth, because the thermal only goes for a certain amount and then plateaus. But then it starts to recede the other way, because now you're starting to see the wheel wear. So you get like this kind of ski jump shape
And are you seeing that in a day?
in a day.
So you
But
see wear in a day. So then the knives that you finish at the end of a day of grinding, there's going to be a nominal change in edge thickness.
so I would say maybe over like 50 Overland Sports, we might that range where we're starting to see the wear and we're going to have to start to comp wear. I mean, in a day, we might in like 50 knives, we might see like a thou in
Okay.
wear. So
It's really
that's
good.
yeah. So like 50 knives, you're wearing like at most 2,000 off the wheel.
And it wears in a uniform way that doesn't require some type of facing or okay.
It
So,
does.
oh, dude, I can't wait to start
Because
messing with this.
we're probably, I don't know, hundreds of sport, m
Yeah.
many hundreds of sports on that wheel. We've not touched it. And that those bevels that I sent you, that was just, we didn't do anything different. We just hit cycle start with the same wheel, no dress, just runs. So
That's amazing.
now grinding bevels is you turn the machine on, and we don't even probe anything, because we found that the overnight like thermal change is so minimal on the X9 that there's no reason to probe XY, because it just doesn't move. And
Okay.
so, because we're not doing anything that generates heat in like the ball screws, because we're not
Right.
moving the machine very much. It's like a very, like our feed rate's like 5 or 8 inches a minute. So it's like the thermal in the X and Y doesn't occur. And so we can just turn the machine on, warm it up, put the knife in, hit cycle start, and then start following that trend on the Z depth. So, and then the bevels come out perfect. I mean, it is the easiest thing to do of all processes in the whole shop. Like if I had to hire someone to do something, that would be
That would
the
be the thing.
bevels would be the easiest thing for me to train someone to do, which is freaking crazy.
If you're in knives, that's crazy. That is not like the starting point for any shop, really. Dude, that's amazing. You are really pushing this process, I think. It's very cool to see.
I believe it is the best way to grind bevels, like, period.
Yeah.
I mean, I
What
just.
is it? What is the, 'cause you can't do a true flat, or I guess you can, but you start to lose, right? It is theoretically possible to do a true flat.
So in you can get an infinitely wide hollow with this
Right.
method. If you let's say this, if you have a knife with a straight edge, like a truly straight line, yeah,
Yeah.
you can do a flat. But if it has any curve, there has to be some infinitesimally small level of hollow to it.
So this, you're saying
So
like if you had, right, if you had a straight blanked blade, no belly, no curvature towards the tip, you could go flat. As soon as you start to go to like a belly,
you're gonna get some, but let me illustrate it. So like the Overland, which is a pretty broad blade, we're running a 6-inch wheel on it. Well, I haven't ran them yet, but I just programmed it. So running a 6-inch wheel on an Overland, which isn't the biggest wheel you can run. We have considered running an 8-inch wheel, but a 6-inch wheel on the Overland with the tip down, because the control for the flatness versus the hollowness is the wheel diameter and how aggressive the knife is pitched in the
So your
machine,
fixture,
the fixturing that
basically. So the angle, the sign like of the fixture, basically angle of the
how
fixture.
far
Okay.
tip down. And so we do 2 degrees tip down on Overland and Sport because we want it as close to flat as we realistically can get. And so with a 2 degrees tip down with a 6-inch wheel, the hollow, if you were to put like a straight edge perpendicularly across the bevel in the middle, is about 1 thou.
Yeah,
So,
all intents and purposes, that like is a flat. And with this, one of the things I'm really excited to experiment, because they do so many different types of knife as customs, is really that ability to be like, hey, I want an 8-inch hollow. Because you can basically fake it in, right?
And so, yeah, you can do any hollow you can imagine it can do, and you can
Right.
get 99.9% of a flat grind. So
Yeah.
it can pretty much do anything, honestly.
Can do anything.
If it's geometrically possible, it can be done.
I love it. Oh man, I'm so it's funny. I don't want to rush it, because I feel like my process isn't efficient enough with the Kihoku yet that I'm feeling like any bottlenecks. That's one that I'm really looking forward to being able to say, like, I have a reason to be faster with grinding.
And that the irony is, to your point, is we looked at those bevels and I showed the guys, Steven and Dalton, and it was like a switch flipped in my brain and all of our brains, I think, that was like, we need to make sheaths faster. We need to make scales faster. You know what I mean? Because the bottleneck of the bevels has always meant that we can afford some inefficiencies everywhere else, because you just have this one bottleneck that's like this fortress of like just blocking your path,
Yeah, there's no way through
and then it just vanished. And I'm like, oh,
it.
we need to. So the second and third biggest inefficiencies in our shop that we did not care at all about until now are now the bottleneck. You know what I mean? So
When at what point though is like you being an optimizer, like at what point is the process and it's done and you're like, this is efficient as it needs to be, I'm moving on to something else.
I don't think that ever comes as a holistic standpoint,
Sure.
but in an individual section, like for now, for like the bevel grinding, like I'm not touching it
You're good.
because
That's done.
my philosophy is like I want to focus on one problem at a time, unless there's an emergency problem that's like I can't ignore.
That's a very good philosophy.
But I'm going to focus on one problem at a time, and it's going to be the biggest draw on our labor. And it's a problem that isn't the biggest draw on your labor is not the biggest problem, because we all know, and like especially American manufacturing, like you cannot afford to waste labor. Like that is the biggest problem. And it's okay to use labor and have labor, but if you're wasting it when you know that there's a better way to do it, that's a tough situation. So I'm looking at the next thing that is the biggest meat on the bone to save labor. And that's no longer bevels. It's been bevels for the entire existence of our company. It's always been about bevels. Now it's not. So phase
That
change.
tracks. I mean, like, I just wrote that down. What's the biggest draw on your labor? I struggle a lot going back and forth between like custom mindset and then production efficiency. And that question right there as a custom maker is interesting, because sometimes like the things that are the biggest draw on your labor are the ones that you enjoy the most.
Well, let me add
that's
this.
Balance.
Maybe saying the biggest draw on your labor is not the right thing. The biggest, where you can identify the biggest piece of labor that you know or can see a path to minimizing it. You know what I mean?
Because it's like, absolutely.
Because your biggest labor on a given product might already be optimized, but it's just your biggest labor just always is going to be.
It's always going to be, right.
But you don't want to have, like, for example, in sheaths, you know what I mean? We have still the Overland being formed with with foam, the mm-hmm. sheath for the Overland. And we went to vacuum on everything, and I never took the time to go back and upgrade the fixturing to make it vacuum formed.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't care that much because I'm like, well, we can't make that many Overlands anyway, because now, the bevels.
Now you have a reason to make that change.
So now the sheaths for the Overland are the drag, and so it's like instantly now I need that done yesterday. You know what I mean? Because it's not that sheaths take a long time. It's that particular sheath is not up to date, and I know that it's a waste. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think it also comes, it's like making the next best decision. Like when you look mm-hmm. at, you're like looking, okay, it's like, yeah, I need to improve these three things, but like, what is the next best decision?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to like integrate that more. Even from the standpoint right now of like reduction, like I realize that I'm doing too much. And so I'm kind of looking at it like, what's the least valuable overall area that I'm feeling stretched in, you know? And then I'm just kind of trying to remove items. It's a reverse process, but that, especially like where I'm at with the Kihoku right now, I think we will start to feel, I think as soon as I bring someone else into the shop, I'll start to feel the inefficiencies in a way that actually allows me to change the inefficiencies too, mm-hmm. because it's like, okay, work through this batch inefficiently. I'm going to update the drawing, the fixture, the, you know, process. Okay. Next batch. Okay. Now we're hitting here, but it's like mm-hmm. when I'm doing everything by myself, like, yeah, I can see it, but I also, sometimes I'm just like, I just got to get it done.
Yeah. Well, and that's the conundrum is like, if you're the one who has to do it and you're the one who has to optimize it, you can't mm-hmm. really do both at the same time. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. if I'm making those Overland sheets, I can't make new fixtures for those.
Right.
You know, so it's like having that third person view of like watching someone do it and you're like, wow, that took them 6 hours and they made how many sheets? Like, that's a problem. You know, not on the employee side. I just mean like on the process
but
side.
But on the process
side. You become very critical when you start watching and you critical the process.
We saw last time, like we did this big pre-order for Cypops, and like we saw, we're not really set up for like bigger shipping
mm-hmm.
with everything else that's going on. And it's like, oh man, like that's, you just bottleneck in like weird areas, and that scale is exponential. It's like, cause mm-hmm. then it slows a bunch of other stuff down, or now you don't have table space, or, you know, it's like just a different flow. Grinding into the big shop change that I've got. I don't think that last time we had talked, I had pulled the trigger on the new mill. It is ordered. It should be here at the end of the month. I'm very excited.
That's so cool, dude. I can't wait to see that.
Dude, I cannot wait. It really, timing is really perfect with them releasing the new Super Mini.
Yeah.
Cause I held off on a mini mill for so long based on like the coolant tank and a few other things. And like this mill, like looking at it, really seems perfect for like everything that I've wanted in a mill, with like smaller overall form factor, fairly affordable, lots of tools, lots of speed, like all the new fun stuff, but also mostly just that it's like small and fits in my shop well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it'll be a sweet machine. I'm excited.
Yeah. I'm excited, dude.
Excited to see you put a cup wheel in that thing.
Yeah, man. I'm a little like, I'm nervous right now just because I realize it's a lot of changes right away. I think my current plan, I've like waffled on this, but I think the current plan is that I'm going to put both of the CNCs in the new shop.
There you go.
And then I think what it'll do is it'll almost let me optimize the two processes, even if it's just in my brain. Like I can look at my shop and be like, my shop is like custom and finishing and like messing with new machines and tools. And then that shop makes parts.
Compartmentalize. Yeah.
I think I need to compartmentalize at this point. So, but that also means that I have to start setting up a second shop while I'm also trying to work. So yeah,
easy.
Some big question marks.
Yeah. Be an adventure, man. Be fun.
I know, man. I think that's like the big takeaway from all of this stuff is like there, to kind of what we said in the beginning of the pod too, which is like, there's not a lot of static, like there's not just coasting.
Well, and I'm going to say this, I know you well enough to know that that you having the opportunity to set up a new shop is a pretty good thing.
I mean, it's a satisfying thing. Yeah. I don't know that it's like a financially beneficial thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think like as far as a focus for a little while, I'm pretty excited and I get to do it different. And that is exciting from the standpoint of not recreating what I already have. It's literally a next step and being like, what does this shop need to do? It's not a default. I'm not even looking at, like, I called you and I was like, hey, like what other machine should I be thinking about or not needing? Cause when I think about setting up a knife shop, like I have all of these specific tools that would go in there. Mm-hmm. I'm intentionally leaving some of those out of the next shop.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Can I ask you an introspective question?
Yeah. Lay it on me.
If you had everything in your whole shop, everything related to knives, all insured to its full value, and the whole thing burned down and you snapped your fingers and you had an empty shop and none of the tools, what would you start buying? Like, what's the first thing you would start buying? Because it's parallel to what you're doing.
Yeah,
right now,
no, but... I mean, for me, it would be, it's the Holy Trinity, man. Yeah. 100%. I would buy a grinder, a drill press, and a bandsaw.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would, from that, I'd probably go into hand tools and a buffer and jewelry stuff. Like, it's a different answer than what you would have.
It would very different. Yeah.
What's the top three? What gets replaced instantly?
So be the X7, the X9, do it over again. They'd be ordered immediately. Honestly, the only thing I would change about everything that I already have is maybe I'd go on a little nicer or different on the blast cabinets, and I would not have gotten the Tormach. That's really the only deviation.
Right. Which is like, it's sad for Tormach because the Tormach, because it did get you started.
Oh, and so honestly, I'm not knocking the Tormach because dude, that thing has run. I was thinking about it, dude. Even today, the Tormach runs more than any of our other machines because it's still running our scales, which by the nature of scales, it's way more spindle time.
Yeah.
So inherently, the Tormach is actually the most used spindle in our shop, even though we have two brand new machines. So, and it's been reliable, dude. It always gives us parts that work. It just does.
Yeah.
But the thing is so freaking slow, dude. It's like watching it move compared to the X7 and just looking at the cycle times.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. It's crazy how slow it is. But I'm not really knocking it though, because you're right. It was very capable and got us started.
Yeah, I know. I guess, that was a really emotional response. It's not far off. At this point, I guess, honestly, like I need the CNC. Like I need it. And maybe it would be some, like three is really hard. I guess it would be a grinder. Dude, yeah, a grinder, the mill, and maybe a bandsaw. I don't know, dude. That's like my brain is glitching because it's the practicality of what like starting versus what my heart tells me I need to like rebuild a shop. Dang, I'm gonna have to sit on that one a little more.
Have you ever envisaged that situation, your shop burning down, and it, in a weird way, actually felt like that would be kind of fun? I know it sounds weird. It'd be terrible, but
No, I cannot say that I have thought of that. I also almost started a huge shop fire one time and it was terrifying. Started a dust collector fire, and the worst part about a dust collector fire is that it basically goes from like a smolder and like you see a flame and then it turns into a jet engine, and it's really like shocking. And then you deal with it and your shop is dirty. So it's like you're cleaning up like this horrible mess and stuff is damaged and it really is like high pucker factor. So yeah, I hope that never happens again. But dude, yeah.
That would be terrible.
The
I'm not.
fun thing is like the fun thing is basically, yeah, you just get to rebuild your shop
Yeah,
with
having a
everything that you
blank,
want.
basically like an insurance check, and it's like
Yeah,
go
yes,
shopping.
that's wonderful.
Because in the very beginning, you're like, well, I can only afford, a Harbor Freight drill press. And so you're like
Yeah.
slowly, you never have that big moment where you're like, build your dream shop in the next 60 days. Like
Dude, I
that.
still have ratchet tools in my shop. Like I've
Same.
got things that I'm like look at and I'm like, it is like budget Harbor Freight. And I've just
Yeah.
been using it for so long.
Sometimes it works, dude. Yeah.
No, I always think that's, I guess my version, your fire question is my lottery question, which is like, if all of a sudden I never had to think about earning an income again, I would actually, basically, we'd probably move and I would set up a new shop. But what would I set that shop up with? And the answer is yes. It would be an endless shop of the nicest, most fun tools ever. That's a fun one. No fire necessary,
Yeah, no
just
fire.
water.
Or someone, here's a better one. Someone offers to buy you out for
Right.
value 3x what everything's worth, which,
Yeah.
because the fire's too sad. Yeah, it's like,
Right. The fire's
no.
sad. Comes with a negative. Okay. Yeah. That's a fun, that's almost kind of like a fun game to play just to look at like true desire. Like, what do you really want in your business? If you look at it from that framework, it's kind of hard to lie to yourself.
It's like if you could do it all over, what would you do different? And then the follow-up question is, why aren't you doing that now?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Good. Let's leave it at that, dude. That
Yeah.
feels like a wrap.
I like it.
All right, man. Hopefully we talk again before I get my mill, but I mean, we will because I'm gonna have a lot of questions. But guys, thanks for listening. We appreciate you. It was nice seeing everybody in Blade, Texas. I really appreciate all the feedback. It was nice to hear that you guys are getting some value from this. So,
No doubt. Yeah. Thank
stay
you
in
all.
touch.
Peace.